You're listening to Neurodiversity at Work.
Life can be so shady. The way some people try to bring you down. Why they got to be so crazy? Always trying to give you the run over.
Welcome to today's episode, sponsored and powered by Dynamis Group. Recently honoured to be part of 300 years of leadership and innovation. We at Dynamis believe that business is a catalyst for positive impact in the world by building a bridge between the top leaders of today and the brightest leaders of tomorrow. We inspire them to do things they have never done before. Welcome to the podcast, another session today of Neurodiversity with Theo Smith and friends. We have an amazing guest today, and there's a couple of reasons why we have an incredible guest. One, Mike is my cousin. I didn't know whether I was going to mention that, but I have to mention
it. Thank you.
There's a connection in terms of our experiences. Both of us, I guess, have been going on separate journeys, and those journeys have collided at a wedding, in fact, where we started to look at our family history and probably see that there's a lot of ND in our family, which is not unusual. So, Mike, I just want to, like, have a real pleasure to have you on the podcast today and to talk to you about your experiences and to share it with the world. Do you just want to let people know who you are, what you do, what you're about? A nice intro.
Hi, Theo. I'm very grateful to be here. It's a big pleasure, big honour. I am Mike Plunkett. My pronouns are he, him. And I have been photographing weddings for 13 years now. And I've been full time with it. It was sort of like a sideline at first. Well, it started out as a hobby, and then it was a bit of a sideline business for a few years. And then I just got really busy with it. And then maybe about 8 years ago, I ditched the day job and I went full time with weddings. And sort of recently, I've always shot like random other things as well. You know, the odd portrait shoot and family thing, and just whatever people would ask me. But I've just like focused on weddings until recently. I've started to sort of diversify a little bit and really enjoying doing some other bits and bobs. But yeah, that's pretty much what I do. I'm self-employed now, mostly doing photography. So yeah,
love it. And so interesting is, photography has not been the thing that you've done all your life, right? You mentioned you dropped into it from another job, which is, you know, I've moved around a few different industries and jobs, and maybe we'll get into a bit of that later. But you're always been creative, right? You were musically, you're incredible. I always remember when we were younger, you were like always on the piano, creative music playing. You're a fantastic musician. And then you've shifted that wonderful creativity into photography. So this has been a line in your in your interest in, I guess, that area of the industry, in people, in music, in entertainment. This has been somewhere you've been, I guess, most of your life, right?
Yes and no, because I do believe that neurodiversity was a barrier for me to kind of follow the trajectory of music in the beginning. I was identified as being very gifted when I was younger, but typical ADHD, I was getting to grade 3 on one instrument and just moving on to the next. And I played flute, the E-flat tenor horn, I had bass guitar lessons, electric guitar lessons, singing lessons, piano lessons. I learned how to produce on a computer at school. You know, I did all these things, which gave me a really good grounding and some good production skills. But I was like not following through, you know, to kind of get to any sort of like expert level in any one of those things. But I was, you know, seen as being very gifted. But I wasn't very good at anything else that wasn't music or drama. I came out of high school with like with music and drama, and that was it. But I still managed to get into music college after that, based on my compositions, my productions. They could see that I was talented, but you had to do an A level in computing as well as the music technology course. And I sat through one lesson, and it was like so overwhelmed. And back then I didn't know how to ask for help. I came out of school just thinking I was completely stupid, you know, for having not done my English and maths and such like. And to be honest, I was a little bit bored with what we started off with in the music lessons in the music technology course, because I'd done some of that at school, because I'd been very fortunate that school had that as a thing as well, my high school. So those two things combined, I just dropped out of music college within a week. Like, I couldn't cope with it. I just, yeah, especially with the computing stuff. So I didn't carry on that trajectory, you know, and nobody was identifying my neurodiversity, and it wasn't in my awareness then, you know. So and I got lots of customer service jobs, which, you know, I wasn't using my creativity or my skills per se, but I then sort of filled in a lot of the gaps where I was missing from the sort of like maths and English. Like, I worked in banking call centers, and I had to learn really good communication skills, and, you know, I got a lot of skills from doing those jobs, which I credit to, you know, why I'm good at certain things now. So it wasn't all bad, but I wasn't using my creativity, and I certainly wasn't on that trajectory of using the talents that were identified earlier on.
So do you think a lot of masking was going on there then, to be able to get into those environments? And were you starting to hide that creativity, push it down, say that actually that's something I don't have the time and energy? I certainly think from my acting, it was like, it was either all in or not at all. You know, it was that kind of sense of I was doing it or I wasn't doing it. And I found that very difficult.
Yeah.
When I had to do jobs like you had to do, which is many of them, which is any sales, call center, whatever job you could get, right, ultimately.
Yeah, and I hated them. I absolutely hated them. They weren't me. I found them super exhausted. I was totally masking. I wasn't really being myself in those jobs at all. And sort of like around that time in my life, I'd taken to smoking weed. Like, I was numbing a lot, you know, self-medicating as reflecting on it now. But I was really numbing regularly, which sort of gives you emotional security and safety, you know, on your weekends and your evenings and whatever. But in time, it depletes your motivation. And what little motivation you have, you're spending doing this job that you're not really in. So, you know, I lived for the weekend, you know, through my 20s. And I did have my late teens, early 20s, did have a party phase in my life. A lot of young people do, you know. But yeah, I was not being fulfilled work-wise. Eventually, I had a friend who was working in a radio station, and this friend told me that there was this course that they did, one night a week for 10 weeks, and you just learn about the different departments in the radio station. So I did that, and I did really well on it, and I won a prize on this course, Best Business Brain, and I got to spend the day with the managing director. And I said to the managing director at the end of the day, I said, look, I love it here. I want to work here. And he was like, all right, okay, let me see what I can do. And he went away and he got me government funding to do a BTEC in radio production. Wow. For the next 3 months. And they gave me a wage. They paid me to study a BTEC in there. It was brilliant. It was a fantastic scheme. And I could do all the tasks that they were asking, and like, I'm interviewing some celebrities and I'm putting together sound bites that are going on air, you know, within 10 minutes, and all this kind of stuff that's going on in the production team. But when it came to filling out the paperwork for the BTEC and referencing everything, I could not do that, you know. I didn't understand it. And again, I didn't know how to ask for help. I just felt stupid for not being able to do it. And I remember sat there needing to do it and just being so overwhelmed by it. that then I would just probably just not do it, go home and smoke some weed, because I was just like so overwhelmed and like, you know, so I didn't get the BTEC qualification, which they were super disappointed by, and the people that funded it was also super disappointed by. But I had the skills, you know, and then a job came up scheduling the adverts. It was a commercial radio station, and there was always a couple of people in each station at that time that would, it would be the go-between, the sales team and the production side of things, to make sure that the adverts actually get to air. And, you know, it's sort of like a, it's a very technical job. It's not creative at all, but I was good at it. I mean, in fact, I got to the point where I could probably do it with my eyes closed eventually. And then I stuck with that job for, I don't know, 17, 18 years, a bit of a gap for traveling, various radio stations. And I ended up in a manager role, and I moved to Manchester for it. And I had one specific job in Manchester for like 8 years. It was just like comfort zone, you know. Yeah. That job was not challenging in any way. And I was really good at it, but ADHD was meaning that I was dropping the ball regularly because you're not being as thorough, you know, because I'm not interested in it, because I'm so bored by it.
And not knowing at the time, right? So this is what we'll get onto soon, but all of these experiences are kind of, you didn't understand what was going on in the brain. You didn't understand the impact that drugs were having. I know they can have a negative impact, whatever, but specifically thinking about motivation, I know that weed, for example, used to have a big impact on my sense of self, on depression, and on starting to think not nice thoughts, you know, starting to go into the spiral of really negative, disruptive thoughts about anything and everything, even like bills or anything. And it became overwhelming because of that ruminating, right, which can be really powerful. Like we were just talking before, when you want to hyper focus on something, but can be really terrible, can really have a negative impact when it's the negative thing that you ruminate about and you can't get out of your head. That can be the thing that breaks you, right?
Yeah, totally. And by the time I was in my last radio job, I was in a stable relationship by then. I had a relationship pretty much throughout my 30s, it was 12 years, that relationship. And I didn't smoke any weed or really do any drugs during that time because I was sort of like reflecting on it now, that it was quite a codependent relationship. You know, we were super close, in each other's pockets and whatever, but that sort of like fed into what I needed in terms of what I was getting from the weed, and where sort of like my addictive energy was going. It went into the relationship, which was, it gave me stability for quite a long time. So I did have this period through my 30s that that was without, you know, without the weed and whatnot. But I never fully dealt with it. I just went from that to the relationship, you know. when the relationship ended, that came back, you know, gradually. And there were other things as well. I turned to benzos. I was doing the party drugs, but only very occasionally. And alcohol wasn't really a massive problem for me until the very end, which I'll tell you about in a bit. And when I say the very end, I mean when I went sober, because I've just crossed my first soberversary a couple of weeks ago.
Well done.
Really big thing. But yeah, so in terms of work, when I sort of like the last few years in my days of commercial radio, I had started to, I needed a creative outlet because the music, I'd stopped doing the music really. It felt like it wasn't going anywhere. So this period of my 30s, I didn't really do any music. So I needed some sort of creative outlet. So I bought myself a camera. I was, you know, out and about taking pictures of friends, pictures of Manchester, that kind of thing. Had a Flickr account. That was the thing back then. That's how I learned. I'm self-taught with the photography. And I was just on Flickr all the time, just like, how have they done that? What lens did they use? And just like, you know, learning. I think these days YouTube would probably fill that gap.
Yeah.
But at the time it was Flickr. And and then a friend of a friend got let down for their wedding at the last minute. And I was like, my friend was like, oh Mike, you should totally go do that wedding. And I was like, I'll give that a go. I absolutely hated it. Like, just rabbit in a headlight. I'd not been to many weddings at that time. So I was like, wasn't really sure what was going on. And I'm always constantly like, how do I get that shot? And I'm just so much pressure. But they were happy with the pictures. And then somebody else asked me, so I did three in that first year. And then the next year was like six. And then it's like, oh, you know, you're starting to charge by this point. And then, you know, after a couple of years, it kind of, by the time, after my days in commercial radio, I had 3 years working at the BBC. A lot of the time that I was working in commercial radio, I wanted to work at the BBC. The BBC felt like such a, I don't know, there was just more substance to it. And because the job that I would do at the BBC wouldn't be about commercial paid for advertising. The role is to advertise the programs and the content, you know. So it's a kind of different way of doing the same thing. And it was great. I really enjoyed my time at the BBC, but I realized that I wasn't going to progress there. I never felt fully at home. I ended up doing the minimum again, like I was doing, you know, in commercial radio. And it wasn't really fully fulfilling me. It was like fulfilling an idea that I had, but actually not my purpose or my calling, if that makes sense. I got really busy.
Sorry, I was just going to say, do you find that is part of the challenge, is sometimes not knowing the direction to go in and therefore following some things through and just going, it's not what I thought it would be. Actually, it doesn't support, at that time again, you still don't know. So it's my brain just isn't fitting in again. Why? I can't quite figure it out.
Yeah.
I enjoy this bit, but that bit, I keep dropping the ball again.
The ADHD brain is constantly but you're just thinking about everything, right? Everything's, you're trying to make sense of it in terms of the head. And I think you can easily forget about what's in the heart. And sort of like, I'm getting there now, I think. It's been a long road. And I'm very grateful for the experience I've got, you know. But yeah, the BBC was a great experience, but it wasn't fulfilling in how I thought it would be, you know. And then I switched to doing weddings full time because I was doing like 25 weddings a year at the same time as working at the BBC. It was like working for two full-time jobs, which was good because it meant I had all pro equipment, all paid for, you know, and the work was lined up for me. And the good thing about wedding photography as well is generally you're booked up fairly far in advance, you know. So I knew that the work was there when I finally gave up the day job. And it went really well for me and until the pandemic, until my relationship split and the pandemic. They were actually a couple of years apart, but it feels like a defined period in my life when the divorce happened, because at that point I stopped being able to do my marketing and my admin work for the photography. I'd been doing it several years by that point. So you get to that point of like, I'm not driven by, you know, excitement anymore, you know, to do this. It's just normal work. I just need to be posting to Instagram all the time. It's like my photography had sort of like got better and better and better, but then it sort of like plateaued around that time as well. So it's like, I'm not really excited about sharing my work anymore. I still enjoyed the weddings, and the good thing about being ADHD and doing a job like that is weddings are adrenaline fueled, and adrenaline makes up for what we're lacking, you know. And it's so super common. I have so many wedding photographer friends who were all ND as well, you know, in one way or another. And you know, weddings, being self-employed, suits being a lot of ND people. And the ones that are generally, and it's most of us, you know, that are creative as well. It's like you get to do something a little bit creative as well. And it's generally something that's self-taught. You know, we don't have bosses. You know, we just deal with happy couples. You know, so it's a completely different vibe as well. But yeah, so that kind of, and then when the relationship ended, I thought, oh, I'm going to give weed another go, you know, because I kind of enjoyed having that in my life, whatever. And for the most part, I was managing to keep it, you know, to the weekends or just, you know, occasional use. But I didn't really have direction post divorce, you know. And I'm smoking weed here and there as well. It's just my life didn't feel like, yeah. And I don't think I was dealing with my emotional side very well at all. I had a little bit of counselling that made me feel a bit better, kind of a short period of counselling around that time. But I stopped as soon as I felt better. And I've always been someone that's managed to... between the divorce and the pandemic, I'd actually stopped weed a couple of times. Like I'd realized, oh, it's creeping up, oh, and I need to stop again. It's this kind of like constant cycle of doing something. And once you feel better, you stop it for a bit. I feel better. Oh, I'm going to give moderation another go. And you start the cycle again, you know? And I didn't really have, yeah, my mental health wasn't too bad. But anyway, cut to the pandemic. I've got my own house now. And I loved the first 3 months. I did a self-portrait photography project in the first 3 months.
Yeah, which you shared on social media, which was great, right? See, this is the thing this is what we struggle with from outside looking in. There's a lot of creativity going on there and like doing something that is completely different to what anybody else is doing and sharing some experiences. And yeah, so the type of work, I mean, we'll share a link if we can, Mike, so that people can go and look at it, right? Because they can then see it for themselves. But it's this brilliant creative work that's going on whilst you're locked down, right? Whilst you can't go out, you're utilizing that time, and probably whilst there's no work going on as well.
Yeah, you know, it was brilliant. It was brilliant. I absolutely loved it. I think all those social pressures being taken away really helped me to focus on doing something creative, and I loved it. It was really great, and it really pushed on my photography as well, because I was using studio lights in my house to sort of like light all the work as well. So it really kind of gave me some more skills. I got it into 6 or 7 different magazine shops, and I had a proper publisher interested in taking it on as well. And that actually fell through because they'd seen that I'd self-published it with a few shots, which was a shame. And I never tried, that's not my lack of confidence, which has been something that's been ongoing through my life as well. You know, I tried the once I won't try again. And you hear, you know, success stories don't come from people trying and then just once and then stopping. They generally come from people trying and trying and trying and trying and trying. I'm aware of that. I'm starting to work on that now. But anyway, so I also had some gallery curators that wanted to include me in a sort of like a post-pandemic art show with that work as well. And they lost their space because of the pandemic, and they ended up moving on from it. And I never tried approaching anyone else. But there were these things that were going to happen. So it was really good. Really good creative work that, you know, could have gone in a bit of a direction, but it's sort of like, oh, kind of my confidence kind of brought me back again. And then the rest of the pandemic was sort of like, I worked when weddings happened again in the summers and you've got all these reschedules. I had a couple of sort of like fairly busy summers, but my finances were not great, you know. Despite getting the grants, it still wasn't quite enough, and not being great with my finances anyway, you know, which I'm also working on now. But yeah, and the weed use went up to, you know, daily over the winters. And I had a couple of like, was it 20 to 21, 21 to 22? Those 2 winters were super dark. I went into full on recluse mode, just blocking everyone and everything out. I got super depressed. There were lots of suicidal ideation as well. I wasn't reaching out to anybody helping. the second winter, I started to have physical issues where I couldn't walk properly. I had like nerve issues because the body's breaking down from, I'm not feeding myself properly. I'm not, you know, yeah, life's having this kind of big, and I'm using benzos from time to time as well. I managed to stop though. I started counseling in January 2022. And then by March, I'd managed to stop the weed. And I went hyper for like a couple of months after that. But it was good hyper. And I was like, oh, I was feeling really good. But emotionally, I was like on a still a bit of a roller coaster. There were many ups and downs. And then it was last summer, I had a binge on alcohol that was like lasted 4 days. And I took a whole tray of painkillers in that time. I relapsed on the weed during that period. I don't fully remember it, but I broke a toe and I ended up like super depressed at the end of it again. And the suicidal ideation. And I was like, oh my God, I'd actually seen a friend who lost a partner to suicide. And had been super open about their grief process on social media. And so when I was having those thoughts again, I was like, I can't do that. I was like super aware of the impact of something like that. And that really helped me to kind of like, I've got to sort this out. I've got to make some changes. I've got to do something. And I was talking about it in my therapy, but it's only going to take you so far. And for me, a really big thing was admitting that I had an addiction problem and I needed to focus on my addiction issues. Because there's so much shame attached to that, you know? I put so much blame on myself for everything that I was doing and feeling like I just created this problem myself, you know? But actually there's so many things leading up to it. There's a more complex story than we can go into today, you know, about where I was emotionally, neurodiversity, you know, my divorce, all those things. It's sort of like that, the thing of feeling like at this point that I'd failed in business as well, which in part was the pandemic, but in part because I'd let things slide since the divorce as well. But again, tied into that is neurodiversity. So many layers to this story. So many, you know, it's quite complex. But I got to admitting that I was an addict. And I made that the focus in my therapy for a while. I bought a workbook on Amazon, addiction recovery workbook that gets you, you know, you fill out all these sort of like exercises. So basically I'm doing at home what you might do in a 12-step program, because I knew that the 12-step program wasn't for me. I'd read some books about it. I was like, that's not for me. It's not for me. And I knew that that wasn't the only way to recover as an addict, because I'd read the book by JVN, Jonathan Van Ness. And they had gone through a process of addiction recovery as well without a 12-step program. So I knew it was possible. And I started to search at what was available in Manchester. And I found a group called Here and Now at the LGBT Foundation in Manchester that's for anybody at any stage of their addiction recovery process. It's just a peer-to-peer support group. So it's not really structured. And for anybody, you know, within the queer community. And I thought, oh, I'm going to give that a go. And I've been going to that group now every week for an entire year. It has been my absolute anchor through this process. And my reminder, because I haven't relapsed once since I finally went sober June. We're in June now, aren't we?
Yeah.
What was I going to say next? What else did I do? There's so much to this story.
Well, after the joining the group and getting the support, and what was the point where you hit the wall? What was in the point where it was like, just because you started to get help, where you hit the wall, where you thought there's something else that I'm not seeing, which led on to then thinking about, the brain, and that maybe there's some other connecting dots that you've not considered, because dealing with the addiction clearly was a huge thing. And then getting the support from the community, sounds like that was very powerful because you've continued it on. But then with this piece around the brain, when did the penny drop where you thought maybe there's something in this, and maybe that's a piece of the jigsaw puzzle that I've not considered that's going to help me move forwards?
I mean, the penny drop moment was the realizing that I needed to go through this new process and phase as identifying as an addict, you know, saying it out loud. And I think that is definitely related to being neurodiverse, because I think when you've spent an entire lifetime masking, you hold on to the way you think and the way you are so tightly, you know, because what most teachers, leaders, managers have been saying to you doesn't ring true for you. So you can end up, and I know this is true for me, I can't speak for everybody, but so I ended up in a place where I'm so tightly in control of what I think and what I do, you know, doing my own thing, my own way, my thought processes. So to kind of come out of my comfort zone and admit that I need to be on this journey of discovery and being super vulnerable, you know, and that is perhaps perceived as, you know, being shameful, and, you know, it's quite a negative thing, you know, which in the end has turned out like to be super, super positive, you know, to admit that and to be vulnerable and to go through this process has been totally what I've needed. And I've been aware throughout this process, and the penny drop was the admitting addiction, is to be open, and to be open to change my own thought processes and to have them challenged, you know, and to let them evolve. It's harder for people with neurodiverse, but cognitive change is still possible, you know. And I think that was a big moment for me. Realizing that the first 3 months of being sober were really difficult, and after I gave up the weed, drinking, the benzos that I was using, all the energy went into sugar, and I was drinking 1 liter to 2 liters of orange juice a day. Like, my evenings were, I was surrounded by bags, family sharing bags of Cadbury's, you know, and I was always quite bad with the sugar anyway, this wasn't new, but I felt like all that energy is just now going into this. So I ended up giving up sugar. And I've always been really sensitive to caffeine. I stopped drinking caffeine as well. And I think the sugar cravings were the worst. And that gave me a focus to not think about the other things that I wasn't doing. So giving up sugar was my focus, actually, for those first 3 months. But it was really difficult. And my mood was super low. And I was going to the group, and I remember, you know, just struggling to kind of get my words out in the beginning, and just feeling really super underconfident, but knowing that I had to push through, you know, and being, I was fully committed to the journey, because I couldn't go back to where I was, like, absolutely couldn't go back to where I was. And it was a 6-month process of getting my well-being good. And then so the back end of last year, I was exercising 6 days a week. I was meditating every day. I was feeling really good. You know, and I was way more likely to make it to my desk. But staying here or being focused, I was still really, really struggling to get my work done. And the overwhelm of being years behind this kind of place that I'd got to was not great. It was a real barrier. And throughout this whole process, I was aware, like, it was a friend that floated the idea to me that I might be ADHD, maybe like two and a half years ago now. So I've throughout this whole process of, you know, addiction recovery and the pandemic and whatever, it was ticking away. I was getting used to the idea, because at first it's kind of like, oh, it's such a big thing, isn't it? And you don't really realize. And up until diagnosis point, I'm absolutely 100% sure but I'm also not. Until you get that kind of validation from the diagnosis, you know. So that was a big turning point, and I got that in December, after being sober for 6 months. And that was part of my motivation for it as well, because I knew that the diagnosis was coming up, and I knew that I wanted to try meds by this point, because over the time of realizing that ADHD was a big issue for me, I was like, I don't want meds. But that's part of that control. That's part of that control I was talking about. Like, that's not going to work for me. I'm all right doing my own thing. I just need to do this other one thing, and then everything's going to be okay. That's sort of like a really common sort of mentality that was going on for me. And it was sort of like, you know, once I'm sober for a period, my focus is all going to be perfect. And, you know, and I realized that that wasn't the case. And once I realized that after being sober a while, I was, I'd like to try meds. I'd like to, you know, I want diagnosis. I'd like to try them and see if it's going to work for me. But I was in a really good place when that happened. And it was my focus to be, because I knew it was going to be more beneficial. Like, I knew when I was smoking the weed that I couldn't be on meds, because it was just going to be, it wasn't going to work. I knew it wasn't going to work, you know, or work very well anyway. Maybe it works for some people, but yeah. So then I started meds in January, and it's been life-changing for me, because it's just pushed me past that point of overwhelm where I can just get on with things. It's just given me that extra 10-20% in confidence that means I can follow through on things now. I can push through. It's still uncomfortable. It's still doing things out of my comfort zone, but like, the meds have just helped me hunker down on what I need to do. And I've now since turned my business completely around. So I completely redid my website, my brochure, got some adverts running, got totally focused on it. And bookings are flowing again now, you know, and sort of like, I've got really busy autumn coming up, and I've got loads of bookings already for next year, which is really, really good. And I think since being focused, other work has been coming my way, all sorts of little interesting things that are non-wedding related, because I'm just so much more engaged, you know, than
ready to receive it.
Yeah. It's more like pre-diagnosis, pre-meds, I was taking things to 60-70% of my potential. And now I'm like 99%. There's always a bit more, maybe 95%. There's always a bit more you can do. So I'm like, I'm not going to say 100, but like, I'm taking things a lot further, and I'm realizing my potential. All the things that I've learned over the years by going to wedding photographer conferences all these things that I learned that I just wasn't implementing because I didn't have the focus to do it, you know. I am now, and it's paying off, you know, it's paying off. And I'm starting to come back to my original love of music, which I was starting to work on during the pandemic, but now I'm like, I've done my first gig. I'm finishing tracks now. I'm, you know, and that's my focus. That's my future focus now. So I'm going to continue doing photography. Indefinitely, because that's how I make my living, and I'm engaged in it again now. I enjoy those smaller things now, because it's making a difference to me. But I'm also now starting to formulate a future plan.
What's interesting? Yeah, no, it's good. No, everything's fantastic. So there's a few things that you've been mentioning that kind of culminate to what you just said there, which is you're going to continue to do your photography because that earns you money while you focus on your interest as well, your additional interest, because you're an exceptional photographer. So like that is a skill that you have there that you can that other people can benefit from your incredible work, right? But what made me think is this thing around a lot of people, and especially if we think about the ND community, know they want to do something different. They want to change their lives. They want to change what's happening. But then they put it off, right? And that may be stopping smoking weed. That may be leaving the BBC to do photography, or leaving photography to do music, or whatever it may be. I don't know. It's that true. It's always like it's the overwhelm, as you described it, that kind of stops you stepping over the line. Somebody described it the other day on a podcast I did as your floor becoming your ceiling, which I thought was great. You constantly, you don't step over the line, so your floor becomes your ceiling, which means you never get anywhere near your potential because you just can't get beyond the floor. And
it's what
you're saying there is one that the drugs are helping you just get beyond your ceiling, the floor in that instance, and just start stuff where perhaps you couldn't before. But also, I think that there's a lesson in there for people who are listening who really want to shift their focus. And that is, you've got to shift it before you want to properly start it. So your photography business was up and running before you left the BBC, right? Your music production, whatever you end up wanting to do with that, right? You're a successful photographer. However you want to define it, you are, right? And, you know, we can put different values against that, but you have skill and ability, and therefore success is on that basis. And then there's the monetary success that will come through the business now flooding in because you're wide open to it. But I think for other people out there, I think it's a really important lesson that, like, you have to be ready to receive, right? And therefore you have to do something to get yourself in a position to receive. That's either psychologically, to receive advice from people. If you're not at a place where you've taken the steps to listen, you can't heed it. If you've not taken the steps to be able to do that new thing you want to do, you're not going to do it. You're not going to get there. And I think many of the things that you've shared with us are about taking these steps over here rather than thinking, tomorrow I will just be able to do that wonderful thing. You may have the ability, the skill, the aptitude, the whatever else, but you still have this feeling, which is your floor. I just wanted to kind of wrap that up because I think this is the sense and feeling I'm getting from this journey, and it resonates so well with me. So let's talk a little bit about, Mike, about as we finish up now, I want to talk about some of the wonderful things you've done around, like, slowing your life down and just being able to connect again with Mike, body, soul, because even we were talking about it earlier, but meditation can be difficult for some people who are ADHD, again, probably because getting into that state of calm is when the brain, they've been so used to feeding the brain, can be a challenge. So just talk to us a little bit about those things that you now do to bring calm to your life so that you can reconnect with your mind, body and soul.
Yeah, I mean, meditation is something that I've done on and off for many years. Yoga came into my life in around 2018, and there's a meditative element to that as well. But at the point that I went sober, I started to meditate daily. At that point, it became part of my routine. And I don't think I've ever found it easy. And back then I didn't find it easy, but I found it rewarding, comforting, beneficial. My whole practice that I've just kind of like made up myself, really. I have a bit of a routine, and, I will sit cross-legged on a cushion because I don't have very good flexibility. So the spine is up straight. This is apparently very good for your energy. And I've got a playlist of calming drone-like sounds and music on Spotify that I will put on. And I've read about meditation sounds very spiritual, and I think that puts some people off. But if you're not spiritual and you're very science-minded, then people can look up NSDR, non-sleep deep rest. And this is the science community's way of sort of defining the benefits of meditation, really. And I think in short, that's about zoning out. So that space that there's a sort of how best to describe it. So you when you zone out, you get your eyes open and you zone out, and all of a sudden you've got your entire peripheral vision in focus. Like, I'm not looking at any one thing, but I can take in the entire scene. And that's a sort of like a visual state that we go into when you zone out, you know. You're not looking at anything specific, but I'm aware of what's over here and over here. That same state you can do with your eyes closed as well. So you do it with your eyes open and kind of get used to it. And research tells us that going into this state for 13 minutes a day is really beneficial for all sorts of physical and mental thing, you know, your focus, keeping calm, regulating your emotions, your amygdala, which would be the thing that would be going crazy with anxiety. If you've got a lot of anxiety and that kind of thing, it helps that calm down as well. So yeah, that's the kind of science side of it. And I do take that into consideration about like the zoning out as much as possible, but that doesn't necessarily stop the monkey mind, the thoughts that are triggering off, as you described it before, the popcorn. This is going off all the time. So there are other things I do, and when I sit down to my meditations, I almost let my mind do some work in the beginning. I'm not like sitting there and like, okay, we've just got to switch it off, you know. And it's like, you know, so I'll do gratitude, because there is research tells us that this is really good for mind and motivation and positivity. It almost flips. It can help flip somebody that's in a bit of a negative cycle with the mind, is to start thinking about the things that you're grateful for. So I'll be like four, and it doesn't need to be a lot. So four or five things, and it can be whoever or whatever, you know. If you don't have anybody in your life that you're happy with right now, then maybe there's an inanimate object that you're grateful for that's in your life, you know, then start there. You know, the goal is to end up being thankful for even the things, the people that potentially upset you, because they're potentially giving you lessons. There's things you can learn from there. And I'm sort of maybe getting to that stage now, but in the beginning, it's just whatever. What am I grateful for? I'm very grateful very regularly for my cats, you know, because they provide me so much comfort. And through the corner, hello.
Cute yeah. Poodle, Roxy. Yeah, just so she just happened to walk in when you said, I'm grateful for my cat. She's like, wait a minute, I'm getting some action.
But the cats are nowhere to be seen. They're already sleeping somewhere. So I do gratitude, and then I check in with myself. Checking in with myself and just sitting with my emotions was also a massive turning point for me when I went sober, and how I learned to just not need anything and just deal with everything that came up, is to be able to sit with your emotions, not to fight it. Like, if you don't like the fact that you feel anxious, then you are adding a second layer on top of your anxiety, fighting it. There's a resistance there, and you're in control of that resistance, that second layer. You're perhaps not in control of the anxiety, but you can just bring it back down to just be the anxiety and not the active resistance to the anxiety or whatever the emotion is, you know. By just accepting it. So yeah, that's been a big thing. What I was learning through with that addiction recovery workbook, and what I've brought into the counselling, comes up in the support group a lot as well. So that would be and even if I'm feeling good, I will still check in with myself during my meditation. So it's gratitude, and then a check in with myself. What am I feeling at the moment? And also, that's not just in my meditation, but like across my entire week. My entire day. If I'm feeling something comes up, I'm like, oh, hello, what is this? You're welcome here. And I will stop and think about it. I won't resist it. I won't follow it. I will acknowledge it, and I will think about it. This has been a huge change for me emotionally, because I still get all sorts of emotions come up, You know, it's not like I've suddenly become, I'm still human, you know, and I'm still neurodiverse. So I still overthink all sorts. Dating for me, it's difficult. It's really difficult. I just, what's going on in here? But I'm getting a lot better at sort of like acknowledging it, accepting that and working with it. Part of what I've done over the last year is developing a strong counter voice, the metacognition. So when something is persevering, that's not helpful, it's not serving me, perhaps it's negative, perhaps it's just an old pattern. It's like, well, this counter voice is coming in and being a bit kind and explaining and, you know, or just giving something a bit more positive there. And that takes work. Just like the meditation takes work. So beyond the checking in with myself and letting myself think about where I am at the moment and letting the counter voice do a bit of work on that, you know, just a bit of self-counseling almost, you know, just in those first few moments. And then I'll just try to get to a peace state, you know. And sometimes it's really not easy because you've got those popcorn thoughts going off, you know. But over time, you might only start with like a couple of minutes of doing this because it might be too much for you in the beginning, you know, but research says that 13 minutes is the sweet spot for, I got all that information from the Andrew Huberman podcast, which is a bit more science focused on that kind of thing. I've listened to a few of those, which have been really helpful for me to learn about being ND and, you know, dopamine stabilization and, you know, that kind of thing. So it's about just keep coming back to the meditation. And there are several things that you can do and that I do. So I've got the music playing, I'm actively listening to the music. The thinking about the body and how it feels. So, you know, I can feel my toes. I'm like, I mean, imagine, what do my ankles feel like? I'm sort of like just being aware of being in the body. What are the sounds in the room? And just being present, and then some thoughts will come up and you'll be like, okay, well, come back to the room and, you know, just be in the here and now and just be in a state of peace, or if it's not peace, perhaps you're feeling the anxiety or whatever emotion it is, just come back to that and just feel it, don't follow it, just come back to it and the thoughts and come back to it. It's just constantly coming back, and over time you get better at this, and those periods in between the thoughts will get longer, you know, but you've got to practice it. You've got to work at it. It's not easy. And I think, as you were saying before, I think it takes a few sort of hurdles to even get to that point that you're accepting of doing this, you know, about accepting something new, about accepting that you're capable of cognitive change when you've spent, and it's like when you get a diagnosis at 44, like me, I've spent an entire lifetime almost masking and being so tightly in control of what's going on in here, you know, that it's suddenly you get to this point, well, actually, where I want to get to in life and I want to be somewhere more positive is going to require some big changes, you know, in my thought processes, you know, not for things to happen to me or, you know, but for just me to think in a different way, you know. So it's so there's that as well. And it's been working really well for me doing the meditation. And I can't always do it. I haven't been super consistent. I'm just coming back into a period of doing it very regularly now. And I've just about to finish a 6-week course I've been doing one-to-ones in conscious connected breathing sessions that I've been doing with somebody that facilitates that and also does sound therapy. So there's a sound therapy element to these sessions as well. And since doing that, just to briefly explain conscious connected breathing, you might do mouth breathing. It's kind of circular. You do it for like 40 minutes, but with a guide, and the kind of state that it induces is super meditative. Like, I had some really big emotional releases from doing it. And I've had some really great visualizations and all sorts of, really, really amazing, quite spiritual stuff come up with that. And it's not spiritual for everyone, but it might be just the emotional release. So it might help you physically or whatever. It might be just relaxing because of the sound element to it as well, you know. But it's been really, really great for me. And since I've been doing this, my meditations I'm going into it quicker. I'm going deeper. Whereas I might be getting a bit sort of, tetchy at 9-10 minutes and wanting to get back to the stuff that I've got on. Just recently, I'm sort of like getting to that point or my phone alarm might go off telling me, you're up to your 13 minutes. Like, I don't know, I'm not done. I want to do some more, you know. So this has been really new. And after a year of doing the meditation quite consistently, so it's taken a long time to get to this place, but I'm very happy I've pushed through, you know. I think being ND, for me, one thing is needing constant reminders of slow and steady, you know. It's very easy to want everything all at once and now and for quick fixes, you know. But actually a lot of things really take time, you know. Rebuilding an entire life from the point of, you know, just where I was, the really terrible places that I was, to rebuild to where I am now, being really good, it's a journey. It's a journey. It's taken a long time. You can only change one little thing at a time, you know. You have to break it down to be a lot slower and to accept that it's just little steps towards the goal. And meditation helps me. And to go back to your original question, because it was like, you know, how have you managed to slow down? Meditation has been one thing. Because I actually feel like my life is quite, there's a lot going on at the moment. Like, I've been super busy. There's been loads going on, but I am taking the time to, yeah, sit and do the meditation still, and take days off, because my first few months of the meds as well, I think my first month I worked 7 days a week, 12 hours a day on my laptop, because I was just like, it was such a novelty and I had so much to catch up on, so much business work to do, that I just, yeah, I went crazy and I completely burnt out and got sick. You know, so now I'm like, I have to take days off, and with the kind of work schedule I have, it's just when I feel like it, you know.
Mike.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I mean, it's really powerful and impactful. And I think the journey will be really interesting and resonate with so many people for a wide variety of different reasons. And I think finding the mechanisms to be able to help you progress and move forwards, deal with some of the trauma that comes from all areas of life, but specifically, I guess, some of the realization, I think it connects with a lot of people, that you feel like you've missed out on something, or that something didn't happen as quickly as it could have, or all these things that you're mentioning, that there's a whole journey that you need to go through there. So finding and sharing these ways that you've been able to deal with that and like get over that next step, I think has been really useful, and the level of honesty that you've broken it down with has been brilliant. So I very much appreciate that. Mike, if people want to find you, if they want to get you involved in doing some photography work, because I know your breadth of skills and experience in that space is pretty wide. So if they've got a creative piece of work, I'm sure you'd get involved in that way. And just if they just want to connect and stay close to you, Mike, and follow your work, what should they do? Where should they go?
My wedding photography is MikePlunkettPhotography.com and Mike Plunkett Photography on Instagram. And then you will find me on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn as This Is Mikey P, which is where I share everything non-wedding. So some of the more creative shoots, and I've shot interesting. I did a portrait campaign in Cardiff around Cardiff Pride recently, and I shot a men's retreat, and I did some photos for a DJ, and all sorts of random things. That's all on This Is Mikey P. My start of my music journey is probably going to be shared on that side of things as well. So yeah, there's the two sort of like main things that I do.
Brilliant. And I'm going to share those links. I'll get them off you, Mike, and we'll include them in the description of the podcast. And also I'll put a link in for LinkedIn as well, because a lot of people in that community are on LinkedIn and they can follow you. And I advise you to go and follow Mike and the wonderful work he does. Mike, brilliant to have you on today. Love it. Thanks so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much, Theo. It's been an absolute pleasure and honor. So, and yeah, if my story helps someone, that'd be amazing.
It will do. It will.
Thanks, Theo.
100%. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Neurodiversity, Eliminating Kryptonite, Enabling Superheroes. Hope you enjoyed the show. You can like, share, comment, find us anywhere on any good podcasting host. You can also do some further reading up and buy my book, co-authored with Professor Amanda Kirby, Neurodiversity at Work. You can get it on Amazon with Kogan Page, our publisher, and pretty much any other good bookstore. Enjoy. Look forward to your feedback. And keep listening to the show. Thank you.